This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
The idea that a coked-up ex-radio host knows more about power and public policy than a VV'd-up career politician, it really should show you the level of undergrad hubris infesting the current crop of Greens. To explain why Albanese's actions in office aren't line-by-line Greens policy by saying, oh, he's a dumb really undermines the credibility of anything else said on this podcast. You're either just extremely dishonest or you're just a dumb I mean, I have a lot to say about John Howard, but he wasn't a dumb. We're stuck with the hosts of Chapo Shithouse podcast.
Serious danger to Australia.
Good afternoon, danger dogs. Please put your hands together, make a shitload of noise. Welcome to stand your hosts, Tom Ballard and Emerald Moon.
What's up, comrades? This is Serious Danger. How you doing, Brizzy?
How good is this? The greatest city in the world.
The greatest city in the world. You heard it here first. This is the most unofficial Greens Party podcast in Australia, live in Meanjin, Brisbane, for the first time with me, which is the most important thing.
Emerald's here, everyone.
I'm here. I made it. Look, this podcast is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Greek Griffin, who is somewhere back there.
Wave to the Griff.
He's here. We're extremely excited to be here, and we've got Max Chandler-Mather here as well. He's going to be joining us in a little bit. But first, we have some business up top of the show.
Oh, yes. We should say a huge thank you to our wonderful new patrons who have joined the Serious Danger family, a family that you can join for just $3 a month. Big thanks
like
to
all good families.
Yes, all good families. Jacob, Laura, Jay, Rebecca, Jace, and David, thank you very much for joining. Go to patreon.com/seriousdangerau to get bonus content. Any patrons in the house? Oh, my
wow.
God.
Jesus Thank you. Christ. That's really nice.
Why is there no one sitting up the front? What the fuck's going on here?
Yeah. Some people are going to come in late and be like, oh, sorry.
Don't worry. We're going to get them, like, roast them real
roast
good.
Roast them, yeah. So, Tom, speaking of roasting, are there more people here tonight or at your show last night for the Brisbane Comedy Festival?
There were heaps of people at my
heaps
show last
people,
night,
okay.
Which was very kind, including the Griff. He came along. It was good. I committed the cardinal sin of referring to the audience as Melbourne.
No, you didn't. You're yes. Like, my favourite city in the world, Brisbane.
I was kind of rusty because I finished the Comedy Festival last weekend. I had 4 nights off and then started again and forgot
You said Melbourne like 63,000 times.
I said Melbourne heaps, yes. Yeah. So that was sort of part of the routine. I said Brisbane, they were not happy. It was also very hot in that room and I think they're going to fix that for tonight. But afterwards, the guy from production was like, yeah, people were getting pretty uncomfortable in there. Not because of your jokes.
Sure, so
that
yeah.
That was a good save. Well, you're safe. Coming tonight. Are you excited?
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm excited to hear the joke about me. I also gave you a joke to use last night,
yes.
And I heard it went well, so I'm feeling quite good about that.
You are the funny one.
Feeling quite good.
I needed a shit place. I'll ruin the joke now. I don't give a shit. But I needed a shit place for me to be appearing at next year. Last year I was at the Tivoli. This year I'm at a fucking sex dungeon in the powerhouse. And next year it's going to be Rick's, everybody. That's where I'm going.
Rick's, that's pretty good, right?
Yeah. Rick's bar and backyard.
Yeah, cool. And I was like, not the backyard though, like inside by the bar. You know?
I didn't do that bit.
But. I said he should have, but now based on that response, I'm kind of glad you didn't.
Good try material here at the Good Chat Comedy Club.
Look, I have to know, were there any babies at the show?
Fucking kill me! The baby discourse. We're adding to the baby discourse.
We're legally obligated. It's a condition of being a podcast in Australia right now.
Fuck me. Yes, big story. In case anyone missed it, and I doubt anyone did, but at the final days of the comedy festival, Arj Barker asked a woman with a baby to leave his show. The debate as to whether how disturbing the baby really was, the rights of breastfeeding mothers to go out to events, should they be asked to move. The baby then proceeded to do a media tour.
A press tour, yeah. Yeah, I have to say I was on the baby's side until it went on the press tour. I think it really started to wear thin. I don't know, like, but the discourse surely around, I think because initially it was presented as an issue of like, should women be able to breastfeed in public?
Right.
But was she even breastfeeding at the time?
No, there seemed to be confusion. People were saying, oh, she was literally breastfeeding when Arj told her to get out, or she was just a mother
who is breastfeeding
at the moment.
We need some sort of discussion around how we use that as a continuous verb because it's confusing, isn't it? You're a breastfeeding mother right then or you're a breastfeeding mother as a personality?
It was... I identify as a breastfeeder, yeah. It went everywhere. People were hitting me up because I posted on my Instagram during my festival. We talked about the Melbourne live show, actually. I had a baby in my audience who made no noise for 20 minutes. I asked, are there any Americans in? There was a pause, and then a baby went, meh, meh, which
sounds
killed
like
me. It was the funniest shit ever because they had no baby and then fucking baby. Then the baby made no more noise for the rest of the show, all right? And some people
that's
were like,
right,
oh.
And that baby could learn a little something from that. Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, it's about the quality of the baby, I think.
Quality of the baby, yeah, right.
But people were saying, oh, yeah, this is how you deal with it. I'm like, but it's a completely different situation. If that baby had started crying, I would say, get the fuck out of my show, baby.
Get the fuck out of my show, baby.
Any babies in?
Where?
We do have, we were talking to Jake who runs the room before this. There are 23 single tickets bought to today's proceedings.
Yeah, he okay? was like most single losers ever to any show we've ever had here. It's quite impressive. I see some in the audience there. Andy, how you doing?
Give the single losers a round of applause, everybody. You're welcome here. Oh, very reluctant round of applause there. People were like, get some friends, losers. But I mean, the coverage was insane. I think it was like a media discourse question here too, right? Like yeah. There was wall-to-wall coverage. There was an opinion piece on every side of the argument. Yeah. And she went on, yeah, Project, Today Show, Sunrise, fucking everywhere.
All with the screaming baby.
And I'm like, Iran and Israel about to go to war. What's going on?
Yeah, people are like asking you for your talk, wanting to talk to you for the first time in ages. And you're like, I have a comedy show. I'm selling a book. And they're like, but the baby, Tom.
Yeah,
the baby.
I should have talked more about the baby.
Do the Greens have a policy on this? Do you know?
Where are Greens pro-baby?
I think the Greens are pro-baby. I think the Greens are pro-baby, so, you know.
Can we get a brief poll by round of applause? Who would say, and with allowing for nuance and...
Allowing for nuance.
Non-binary thinking on all issues, but if yeah. you were generally more sympathetic to Arj Barker, give us a round of applause. Oh, yes. Of course, the child-hating Greens. The anti-family movement. And who's more on the side of the breastfeeding mother? Oh, shit!
Wow.
Wow, a lot of people watch
those
interviews.
That's all the single men in the audience being like, absolutely me.
Obviously, if you're a breastfeeding mother, you should be able to go out, and that's fantastic. But, yeah. You know, maybe if you have a baby and the baby starts making noise, you know, if you can step out for a little bit to comfort the baby.
Yes, yeah. Speaking of babies and people who have them.
Yes.
We should get our guest on. Please welcome to the stage, everyone. It is the member for Griffith, the Green spokesperson for housing and the finest student politician in Australia, Max Chandler Mather.
Hello, Max.
Hi, Max.
Hello.
Is your baby here?
No.
Good.
I've got some audio of him crying, though.
Okay, yeah, if you could just play that to test us.
Great.
Yeah. What's your take on this? Let's get you cancelled again.
Oh, man, I feel like one way... I asked Emerald how I could answer this without getting cancelled, and Emerald said, just say you really want world peace.
yeah, that's right. I work in politics. I'm pretty well-versed in this.
And then the other one was my partner Joe was like, well, you should say... that you have to work with a crying baby almost every day and that baby's name is Anthony Albanese. But I would never say that. I would never say that.
You would never say that. That's right.
Come on, Geordies. Friendly Geordies, are you listening? that's brilliant. Okay, and so how is the baby thing going? You had a little bit of a paternity leave earlier on. Congratulations on the arrival of little Felix. How's father life treating you?
Amazing. Very humbling, you know. You, like, on one hand, like, go from some, like, national media interview and then you, like, go home and he's, like, throwing up on your head as he's on your shoulders. Both very stressful in their own ways, but, no, very rewarding. But tiring.
So sad that he'll always have to grow up in a renting household with no housing security because you're probably forbidden from buying a home at this point, right?
Yeah, I was told that a debate broke out in the ABC media room between one group of journalists that said Max can never buy a house and another group of journalists were like, that's insane.
Look, I mean, what does Party Room think?
Well, it has to go to a vote, so.
Yeah. Consensus-based decision-making.
I present my, bank account details. And
Green's Party Room, like a consensus shared equity scheme.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
I mean, like, I was, like, it's a joke, but it's also serious. Like, when you buy a house, that will become a media story, right? They'll report on the value of the house. That will be a political decision that you need to negotiate in some way.
Maybe, yeah. I hadn't thought about it in those terms.
Really?
But no, well, up until the weird ABC journalist told me there was a debate about it. But, look, the funny thing is that obviously at one point I'd like to be able to buy a house, but In the federal electorate of Griffith, the median house price in a lot of areas is well over $1 million. So actually, Joe and I are probably a few years off being able to afford to buy a house in Griffith.
that's extremely depressing.
Yes.
Not that I'm doing it tough, obviously.
Yeah. We have got a crying baby in the room, everyone.
I tell you what's tough. Earning. Yeah. Anyway.
How much exactly?
You got to stop sacrificing 27K of your salary to fund school meals at your local school.
Yeah, and then they got a tag for that. They're like, oh, how much of that is on a tax offset?
You can't win. It's so hard.
Fuck it hard.
Yeah, it is.
Should we crack into the discussion we want to
talk about? Let's talk housing.
Yeah, we obviously want to talk about housing with Max, and there is so much to talk about indeed. I don't think we need to spend too much time on just how cooked it is. We all know that there's a housing crisis going on. There was some data that came out this week that just really filled out the picture a little bit more that will depress everyone even further. Sound good?
Good.
Welcome to Serious Danger. There is not a single property across Australia or even a room in a shared house that's affordable for someone on youth allowance, according to a new report from support organisation Anglicare Australia. And just 3 properties Australia-wide were deemed affordable for those on a job seeker allowance. Of course, affordable meaning you're paying 30% or less of your income on housing costs or rent, otherwise you're in housing stress. The affordability snapshot found rental affordability is the worst it has ever been, with Anglicare describing its findings as nothing short of horrifying. So there's a big snapshot they do every year. In March, they looked at about 45,000 rentals across the country, found that average rents were $200 per week higher than before the pandemic. 13.4% of rental listings were affordable for a family of 4 with both parents on a full-time minimum wage. Okay, and the head of Anglicare said that's crazy. It's normally around 30%, something like that, now down to less than 14% that are affordable. Just 1.8% are affordable for a single parent on a full-time minimum wage. I also saw you tweeting about like rental inflation this week, Max. I mean, again, there are lots of reasons why this is the case, but why are things particularly so horrific and shitty in the rental market right now? And is there any chance, you know, provided obviously all the great Greens policies being implemented, any chance of things getting better this year, I suppose?
Unlikely, very unlikely this year. And I mean, why is it the case? This is like 3 decades coming. You know, you hear a lot of talk about, this is a lack of supply and tight vacancy rates and things like that. But the reality is this is 3 things. One, government's just not spending any money on public housing anymore. To give you an example, by the way, so in today's money, the federal government used to spend $10 billion a year building public housing every year. Now, through the same program, they spend about $1.6 billion a year.
When was that?
That was in the 80s.
Yeah, okay.
So there's that. There used to be rental caps in Australia and rental regulation, and that's all gone. And then at the same time, you basically have a tax system that says, you know, it'd be really great if instead of treating housing as a place to call home, we should treat it as a really lucrative financial asset. And a great way of measuring that is back in the 90s, like the Australian banks, who are the ones that make the most money off housing, about 20% of their lending, which is the way they make money, went to housing. And now today, 60% of their lending goes to housing. That's more than any other country in the world. Like Australia has one of the most acutely broken housing systems. So that's what's going on. And what's amazing is a lot of politicians from the Labor and Liberal Party will treat this as some sort of natural phenomenon, as if it's a tidal wave coming in or an earthquake or like, I was going to say a hurricane, but, you know, that's climate change. This thing that they have almost no control over, and if only we just more supply, and I'm sure we'll talk about it, but it is the most intellectually insulting debate in the world, that like, what about rent caps? No. What about building more public housing? Oh, a tiny bit, but no, not really. What about the tax system? No. It's supply, supply, supply. And they've been saying that for about 2 decades. And literally every year, almost, things get worse. So, you know, it's frustrating.
A little bit tired of it. I'm going to be honest.
Would you say Albanese is a dumb cunt? No.
Absolutely not, and I condemn that language. You could...
Thank you for finally saying that.
Sorry, yes, yeah. Thank you for bringing us into line. Let's briefly just sketch out the current policy debate. Last time we were here doing the live show with you, Max, here at Good Chat, we sort of went deep on the half, why it sucked. Eventually, of course, the Greens gave support for the half after winning some big concessions. We did not get a national rent freeze. That's what we were pushing for. We didn't get there. We did get billions of dollars more in social housing funding, which was great. Some concessions, but not everything we wanted. Right now, the big housing fight is around the Help to Buy shared equity scheme, which we have sort of gone into depth with on the show before. Maybe if you wouldn't mind, Max, a really brief summary of exactly what Help to Buy is all about,
why it fucking sucks,
and where the parliamentary fight is on Help to Buy.
So basically what the Help to Buy scheme is the government will open 10,000 places a year to people who don't own a home, who earn individually below $90,000 a year or as a couple below $120,000 a year, and they'll part purchase a house with you up to 30% of the equity of a home and up to 40% if it's a new home. You know, it's really complicated and only 10,000 places. Now, there's a bunch of problems with this. One, much like the first home buyer's grant, literally all it's going to do is drive up the price of housing. Now, the way to think about this is anyone who has access to this scheme will go to an auction be able to bid more for the price of a house because they have that extra money, which means any other first home buyer there is just going to watch the price of that house get bid up. Now, the other crazy thing is that there's caps on the prices of houses you can access this scheme. And this is why it's actually not worked in a bunch of other places. So New South Wales has this scheme. They have 3,000 places a year. Does anyone want to take a guess at how many places were actually taken up last year? 200, lower than that.
Zero.
124. it's an unfathomably dumb idea. I think the worst bit about it is they'll get up and say, oh, by holding this up and trying to push for, say, caps on rent increases or building a lot of public housing or phasing out tax handouts for property investors, you're denying all these people a home. There are about 5 million renters in Australia, which means that every year about 0.2% of renters will get access to this scheme. And for the other 99.8%, well, too bad. You have to wait for more supply whenever that comes along.
Well, and not just too bad, right, that it will make things actively worse for you because it'll be harder for you to buy a house because they'll be more expensive.
That's right. And look, it's true to say that this is such a small scheme that it'll have a small impact on house prices but will have an impact on house prices. Mm. And I think the way to sum it up is the housing debate at the moment is you have a property investor prime minister. He has a bunch of property investors. Their only bill they have this year to solve the housing crisis is one that will push up housing prices while at the same time refusing to touch the tax handouts for property investors, claiming there's no more money in the budget for public housing when they just found $50 billion for new defence spending, which, by the way, if they spent $50 billion on public housing, we would clear entirely the public housing waitlist. But they found that for like submarines or whatever the hell else they're going to spend it on. And no rent caps because apparently this is the best thing about the debate about rent caps, which if you think about it, even in basic terms, makes no sense. They're like, oh, that will drive up rents. And you think, you're like, oh, okay. So, and why? Well, because property developers need high rents to incentivize them to build. And you're like, okay. All right, I'm following. And then if they build lots of houses, rents will go down. And you're like, oh, wait. But I thought if rents went down, they wouldn't build houses. No, it's different this way. Anyway, the other dumb thing to think about it is if there's a cap on rents, unless that investor wants to break the law and exceed the cap, then rents are actually going to go down. So anyway, again, very frustrating.
This is the thing. You make murder illegal, you just push it into the black market. Yeah. Want to do it more. I don't know.
Just to go back, I just want to clarify on that point. In New South Wales, where they have a similar scheme, you're saying there's 3,000 available slots, but only 300 people took up because of the limit on the price of the house that people could
for a variety of reasons. It's deeply complex. There's so many different criteria that you have to meet that it's difficult to access. If you think about it, if there's a cap on the price of house, you can access it. The moment the price of that house, say you're in an auction and you can only get this scheme if the house is $650,000. The moment it goes a dollar above that, you can't access the scheme.
Right.
None of these things work. And really, if you think about it, any scheme that involves giving more cash to people to go into the private housing market to bid up the price of housing is only going to make housing more expensive. Mm. It's pretty much as simple as that.
No, I think we should try it one more time.
Okay.
So does this also have to be, is the parliamentary fight on Help to Buy, again, Greens are saying we're not going to pass this without some concessions. Does that all need to be sorted out before the May budget? Is there any negotiations going on? Are you chatting to the baby Albanese? What is happening?
I don't think Albanese is a baby.
we are filming this for video, by the way.
It's a joke. Kurumal. Look, no. So it's just come back from an inquiry where basically like every economist that went there said this is a bad idea and it's going to – even like conservative economists, like people that otherwise hate the Greens were like, no, the Greens are right on this. Like this is just going to push up the price of housing. Like we managed to Labor's managed to unite like right-wing and progressive economists for the first time on how bad their scheme is. But no, it won't. It can happen after negotiations can happen after the budget because it won't come back to the Senate for a few months. Right. So there's still some negotiations to go.
Negotiations.
Sorry, Canberra's infecting my brain.
And I guess my question is like, are we cutting through on this? I mean, that's great that you know, expert economic opinion is sort of lining up behind us. Of course, there's been lots of instances where that doesn't mean fucking shit. I mean, for your average punter, you might suggest have some sympathy for the argument that the housing market is fucked. Labor tells me they're trying to do something. The Greens are holding that up in some way. What's the deal there? Surely we should be throwing everything we can at this problem. I don't know. Are we cutting through? Are we explaining why this scheme sucks and providing an alternative, a better alternative at the moment?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's been a bunch of polling around this, and one of the more remarkable things is how few people think that Labor is doing a good job tackling the housing crisis. I think it's in the single digits. Yeah. Any poll, national poll done on, say, phasing out negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, a large majority of Australians support it. Even 51% of property investors think we should phase out negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. The last time it was polled, 61% of Australians thought we should freeze rent increases. There's even on the Greens' idea to say establish a public property developer to go out and just build homes and then sell them and rent them at prices people can afford, like a lot of European countries do. It's something like 70 or 80% of Australians support that. So there's these... The frustration is there are these huge majorities that support really substantial action on the housing crisis. And fair enough, given it's affecting this huge group of people. Single digits of people think that Labor's doing a good job, and yet Labor still refused to shift. And, you know, the big question is why. And I think it's a few reasons. But one is genuinely that the Labor Party is so enmeshed and captured by the property industry, it's not even funny. And probably the best way to sum it up is they established this thing called the Supply and Affordability Council, which is their expert body to advise on the housing crisis. They appointed she was literally at the time the CEO of Mervac, one of the largest property developers in Australia. She's now the outgoing CEO of Mervac. Mervac, by the way, who when they did rent to buy in Sydney, bragged to their shareholders that their build to rent, bragged to their shareholders that their rentals were 20% above market rent. They were like, these are so good, we're making so much money. And that's the company who had a CEO who's now heading up the government's expert body on tackling the housing crisis. So you can imagine how that's going to go. Really well.
Make it make sense, folks. Yeah. Well, I guess also from this week as well, we had Pocock and Lambie coming out and sort of releasing this support or this report they commissioned for the Parliamentary Budget Office about winding back these concessions, which is generally good news. I'm interested in sort of the differences there between them and the Greens' position. Independent Senators Jackie Lambie and David Pocock commissioned new modelling from the Parliamentary Budget Office on the impact of limited negative gearing and capital gains concessions. It could save the budget up to $60 billion. And they want to grandfather it in. Pocock said, going forward, you would only get the capital gains tax discount if you're investing in new supply. Home ownership is declining. Rental affordability has never been worse. We need to make sensible changes. Lambie admitted the solutions were not a magic bullet, but would go a long way to making housing more accessible for those who need it most. Show some courage and start making more moves on the game board.
I was wondering when the impression was coming.
Oh, the impression is coming. Don't you dare get between me and an incredible impression. And all my wonderful satire. What should we think about this? Are they pretty much saying, hey, Greens policy are good? Is there coordination between these senators and what the Greens are on about? What's going on there?
Well, it is a good thing because basically now it means we have the numbers in the Senate to phase out negative gearing and capital gains. So basically the Greens plus Lambie and Pocock, and if the Labor Party came on board, means we have a majority in the Senate to pass changes to negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. It also demonstrates just how broad a public consensus there is on this. And, like, one of the things the sort of, like, Labor insiders will say is, well, we went to the 2019 election and we lost because of negative gearing. Like, it takes about half a second of interrogation to realise how complete and utter bullshit that is, because you look at the seats that Labor got the biggest swings in the 2019 election, and they were the seats with the highest rates of people who were using negative gearing. Like, so, and, you know, there's a lot of reasons that I think Labor lost that election. I really think negative gearing is definitely not one of them. Mm. But the other thing to think about this is the housing crisis has got substantially worse from 2019 to now. Mm. And unless we touch these tax handouts and phase them out, there is no way we're fixing the housing crisis. And if you think about it in these basic terms, in this coming federal budget, the budget will probably spend somewhere north of $30 billion, if not more, on these tax handouts, which means that the biggest line item in the budget for housing will be tax handouts for property investors. And imagine if instead of that, we were spending all of that money building public housing. There'll be like hundreds of thousands of good public homes. So, look, it's a no-brainer. And the crazy thing is that Labor always has this remarkable ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Because here they have this historic moment, the worst housing crisis we've had in generations. A progressive majority in the Senate and this huge public polling results that show large majority support for rent caps, phasing out the tax handouts, mass investment in public housing, at the same time as we have a downturn in the private construction market, which means that there's these skills and materials we could put to work building public housing. And despite all of that, the best conditions we've had since post-World War II to do something substantial in the housing crisis, and still Labor refuses, which I think says, like, it's genuinely shocking. I've even chatted to some Labor members who are quitting at the moment because they are even shocked. Like, we had this guy come to one of our pop-up offices who has been a Labor member his entire life. Like, he's in, like, his 70s, and he came along and he's like, I don't understand. Like, it's bizarre. I can't find a reason. And for me, I just can't get beyond, like, an ideological opposition now, I think, to any substantial action in the public sector on housing or interfering with the private market at all. And genuinely, they just are so enmeshed with the property industry. They go to the same parties. They take the donations. They're really tied to the big banks. Like, it's not clear that institutionally they're capable of doing anything.
Mm. Is it not also the political calculus they just cannot be seen to be doing anything that the Greens want to do?
The Greens political party.
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I mean,
thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Really,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah, that should get a round of applause, actually.
Yeah. Really well done.
We've seen before, right, where the Greens have pushed for something and then all of a sudden Labor announces it as their own idea. And no one in the media picks up on the facts. Like, literally no one is like, hang on, didn't, like, last week the Greens say to do this? No. It's, like, amazing that Labor did it. Genuinely, if the Prime Minister came out of the budget and said, we're going to spend $10 billion a year building public housing, the largest build of public housing since post-World War II, we're going to fund it by phasing out negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount, and, hey, states, if you want more funding from the Fed, from us, you're going to have to take action on rents. Like, no one, sure, we might get a bit of credit, but I think most of the focus will be on Labor taking the biggest action on the housing crisis.
And, like, a bunch of op-eds about, like, is this the age of Jackie Lambie?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
that's right. Yeah, exactly. It'll be like, wow, I can't believe David Pocock did this.
But, and also, surely the lesson from the Labor's shifted position on stage three tax cuts, which, again, we can critique all day, but they changed their mind, they changed their position, it was politically popular. All the broken promise bullshit has almost immediately been forgotten, and because they did a good thing, you know, compared to maintaining the status quo, but they don't seem to have learned that lesson at all.
No, and, you know, the Prime Minister said when economic circumstances change, so should government policy.
Yeah.
Which is a really rational thing to say, actually. Like, you think that's sort of how governments are meant to work. But apparently not. But apparently not. And Labor is shedding votes over this. Like, let's be clear. Mm. And, you know, their primary vote is going down almost every poll. There's been a steady decline now for the last 6 months. It's a pretty simple reason for that. Because if you're a renter, you're getting smashed by historic rent increases. And literally the only thing the government is saying is do more of the same. Like, that's what most people hear when they say supply. Because people see private luxury developments built down the road for them. And sure enough, it actually often means rents are high in the area when those apartments are built. They see nothing on negative gearing. Parents of kids who can't afford to buy their houses. These are parents who might be wealthy themselves, are wondering how the hell their kids are ever going to get any meaningful step into the housing market. And you've got a growing number of people who in, say, 40, 50 years ago could have moved into a good public home and are now either living on the streets or paying 80% of their income on rent. And these are people who've never voted Greens before and might disagree with us on a bunch of things. But as long as we're the only ones out there talking about this, this is going to cause them huge problems. And maybe it's going to take a few elections where they suffer huge swings against the Greens in a bunch of seats. Maybe pick up a few more seats before they realise that they're going to have to choose between electoral oblivion and taking action on the housing crisis. And it's not clear that Labor will choose take action on the housing crisis.
October state election, anyone?
Yeah.
Well, we thought we got a bit of time and space to get into some thornier issues surrounding the housing debate, and we thought we might do that through the prism of the Q&A episode you did about a month ago. And if you think we're not going to go through a Q&A episode at a live podcast, you don't know serious danger. This happened about a month ago. It was a special they did at the end of March. It was called Home Ownership, Homelessness and Housing Supply. The panel featured yourself, Labor's Andrew Lee, who is not the federal housing minister. Do we know why the federal housing minister was not on that panel?
No, I've been on a bunch of shows where, as I understand it, they've invited the housing minister on and she's always been busy. So
interesting. New South Wales Labor Housing Minister Rose Jackson was there, Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg, economist Cameron Murray and Captain Little, who's the chief executive of the Secretariat of National Aboriginal and Islander Child Care. Did anyone watch the Q&A episode?
Yes.
The vibe of this midday show is electric. You didn't watch it?
I didn't watch it.
Do you ever watch Q&A?
Not for a long time.
Long time, yes.
Not until I was a young, you know, wide-eyed, greenie, just watching Larissa on Q&A. Those were the days.
God. a month on, Max, how do you feel about that particular panel? How was it fun?
Look.
Do you regret your actions yet? We all saw the screen cap that, you know, you speaking in the presence of Rose Jackson.
Yeah, that was an odd tweet. It was very intense. The show's at, like, was it like 9:30 at night?
Yep.
Really late.
Yeah, and you know, it's an odd time to have a current affairs show. But look, I think any opportunity to talk about the housing crisis is a good one. I'm trying to be diplomatic.
All right, politician Max.
Yeah. Diplomatic as hell.
Change.
That's not what we're looking for. I thought we'd run through some of the bigger moments that came out of there, which might lead to some bigger conversations. I mean, the supply question, basically, if you didn't see the episode, it was basically Max going up against the supply mantra, right? At every single turn, you're constantly going in there. Andrew Lee said that it's kicked off at the start. There was a period where home ownership peaked, not because we allowed people to rip money out of their savings accounts, not because we ran some sort of housing lottery, but because we invested in supply. And fundamentally, the problem, Isabel, is that this is, we're not building enough homes. We've got 4 homes for every 10 Australians, and that's low for the advanced world. We've got to build more homes. Now, that seemed weird to me that there were, you know, 4 homes for every 10 Australians, but I guess it does technically check out. The populations are 27 million people. There are almost 11 million dwellings, so it's about 40%. So it kind of works out. But I suppose we saw this again and again and again, this idea that, yeah, simple laws of supply and demand, we don't have enough houses, we need more supply. It seemed like what you had to argue and what we are constantly trying to break through this debate is to talk about the nature of that supply and the nature of the demand, right? Like supplying luxury apartments is not going to solve the housing crisis, and the demand of property investors should not be equal to the demand of people who need a fucking roof over their head. Is that your task still? Did you feel like you broke through at all of that conversation? Is that where that debate is still going?
Well, it's interesting. Like if you look at polling, often one of the, there was a private Queensland government poll where one of the questions they asked was relaxing planning restrictions to encourage the supply of housing as a solution to the housing crisis, and it was the least popular option. Like I think a lot of people intuitively understand it's dumb. And just to start on the Andrew Lee comment, that's just also not true. Like there's a big home ownership increase. The biggest increase in home ownership occurred between the years 1950 and about 1970. And 3 things were the case. 1, Australia largely had large-scale rent caps. Now, what rent caps do is make investing in homes to turn them into rental properties less lucrative for property investors. That means there's less property investors in the market trying to buy a house and bidding up the price of housing. It's a less lucrative asset. So the first thing that happened was it was a lot more affordable to buy a house in that period. The second thing was the federal government, rather than relying on the supply of the private market, in some years, 15 to 20%, sometimes as high as 20%, 26% of all houses built in Australia was public housing. And what the federal government did was then rent it and sell it at hugely discounted prices. And the other thing is we didn't have a tax system that encouraged homes to be treated as a financial asset. And the big shift happened in the 1990s. Like, it's like house prices and wages go like this until about the 1990s, and then they go like this. And the reason that happened was a few ones, but one of the major ones was, A, government stopped, mostly in, led by Labor, stopped investing in public housing in a large-scale sense and let the private housing market rip, and look how well that turned out. All of the, any some form of rental regulation was largely gone by the 1980s. And then you had negative gearing, which already existed, but then it was combined with the capital gains tax discount. Now, this is a bit boring, but it is actually important to understand. What the capital gains tax discount is when a property investor sells a home and say they make a $500,000 profit off that, so the difference between when they bought it and sold it, 50% of that profit is tax-free. They just get it tax-free. Now, when you combine that with negative gearing, a property investor can go and buy a property investment. They can make a huge loss on it every year, write that entire loss off on their income, so sometimes get their taxable income down to zero. So they're making money that way. And then when they sell it, they have make this huge profit. And what happened is you watch it the year after the capital gains tax discount was increased. Before that, house prices went up about the same price as wages. The year after that happened, or about that, house prices went up at, on average, close to three times that of wages every year. And the idea was that it's so deeply intellectually insulting to suggest that the reason that shift happened was actually just because all of a sudden Australia stopped building homes. Mm. And the kernel of the supply argument, really, if you drill down to it, it's that no one out on that panel, apart from, I suppose, me and maybe Catherine Little, were suggesting that actually we should just have a mass build of public housing. What they're getting at is we need to, when you drill it down, their policy is deregulate the housing market to allow property developers to build more homes. Like, that's their argument. Yes. And they're like, oh, if we get a huge supply of private homes, then all of a sudden the price of housing will go down. That seems to be their implication.
Right.
And if you think about it in basic terms, and if you watch the way the Australian housing market works, it doesn't make sense. So the first thing to know is right now, this is a bit boring, but it's useful to know, there is a record number of approved developments that developers are not building. So basically, they've got their planning approval. They can build a big tower if they want to, and they're choosing not to because developers only ever build when it is profitable to do so. In fact, they're on the public record. Harry Triguboff basically was quoted in this story in The Australian a few years ago. He's a big, I think, of Meriton, head of Meriton. In the same article, on one hand, he says, well, the price of housing is going up at the moment, so I'm going to hold on to these apartments and not sell them because if I hold on to them, the price of housing will keep going up and then the value of what I'm holding will go up. And so that's great. So he's drip-feeding the supply of housing, right? And then the other end of the article is like, oh, the solution to house prices is more planning deregulation.
But when you say, like, if you say that it's not profitable for developers to build housing right now, isn't that the argument of these people who say, oh, we need to give further concessions to property developers because that's why enough homes aren't being built, is because it's too difficult for them to build it. They'll lose money.
Yeah, and sometimes they do. But I suppose the point is that, sure, you can give them more money, but at the end of the day, the way they make money is selling housing at the highest price possible. Mm. So even if they get all these other concessions, what they're going to do is only ever build that apartment block, mostly, by the way, when they've sold it all off the plan. So this is the other thing. There's a developer out there, recently a development, 80% of the apartments were sold already before it was built at a really high price. Then they decided not to build it because they couldn't sell the other 20%. Fuck. Now, if you followed Andrew Leigh and the Labor and Liberal Party's argument, in their fantasy world, what should happen is that developer should just build it anyway and then sell the last 20% of those apartments for a reduced rate. But that's not what developers do, and it's like never how it's worked. And really the only solution, we've talked about it all of it, but this is the purpose of the public property developer. Because instead, if you had a large-scale public property developer who said, screw your profit maximizing activities, we're going to get every piece of land we can in the city, and we're going to build the best quality apartments and sell them and rent them at massively discounted prices. And hey, developer, if you're not building on that land, we're going to get it and we're going to build on it anyway. What happens is the developer down the road, when they finally do build their apartment, will be competing against a public property developer that's renting out it cheaper, building much higher quality apartments. And it also means that vacant land can't just be left vacant for 10 or 20 years when a developer's decided eventually it's profitable to build. And so really, as in any market, right, where you have basically this sort of collective monopoly, the only way to break it is to have a public option. And you would say that in electricity. You would, like, imagine schools, right? It's a good way to think about it. Imagine if there was only private schools and the price was completely deregulated and they would get to decide how much the price is and when they build a private school. Like, I think we can guess what would happen to the price of schooling. Same with healthcare, same with any essential to life. And it's just because of this ideological break that happened in the 90s, led by the Labor Party, that there's this sort of malaise over the mostly the media class. I think the public gets it. That we just have to accept the fact that one of the most essential things for life is basically set up as a lottery where the vast majority of people lose and a few small few banks and property developers get to make massive money screwing most of people over on it.
Because it's a consolation prize for the alternative, which is where people can aspire to or look forward to, like a well-funded, you know, social security system and healthcare and services and a good wage. Instead, they get this chance that maybe they'll get to be a landlord.
Yes.
Like, that's the second prize that we've been offered.
Yeah, that's right, and way to grow wealth. And, you know, and I'm sure we'll get to it, and that the other sort of like third rail of Australian politics is house prices, you know, and like, oh, well, at the very least you get to own this, like if you get it. And that worked, I think, up to a point, right? Like up to the 90s when wages and house prices were sort of similar, the deal was, especially that brief moment, probably from the 90s to the 2000s, that brief moment where they said, look, your wages aren't going to go up a lot. Your cost of living is going to go up. At the very least, we're going to get you a home, and that home is going to accumulate so much in value that you can borrow against it and improve your life. Problem is now increasingly, certainly a majority of our generations can't afford that. And so they're completely locked out of this social contract that now is completely disintegrating. Because it doesn't work, right, if you don't own a home and your wages are still stagnant and you've got a massive student debt and you've just got these now this very lucky property investor class who are the only ones who really win out of this system.
Well, speaking of, you got a question directly from a member of that demonized political class, Anne-Marie, the demonized landlord. She said, owning property is a business and takes time and effort to make sure all is running smoothly. I'm just so angry that as a landlord, I shouldn't have to feel guilty about owning property or properties in my case. Why did you include that, you idiot? You fucking moron. Why does it appear that all landlords are demonized and put in the same bracket? All right, this was Anne-Marie. We all loved Anne-Marie, and fucking credit to you, Max.
Landlord as a protected class. Amend the Anti-Discrimination Act now.
Landlord is a slur, as we've discussed. I mean, full credit to you, Max, because you said in a very diplomatic way, I thought, you just sort of said, look, I'm sorry, but your interests are not the same as those of renters. And if we change these things and make this a fairer system, you might have to sell an investment property. That might be difficult or annoying for you, but that's less of a concern to us than the squeeze that the rental crisis is currently putting on renters at the moment in this very cooked, unfair housing system. I mean, I guess, yeah, what did you think of Anne-Marie? Did you find out how many properties she had? What were your thoughts of that particular interaction?
No, and it actually reminded me when we first announced the freeze on rent increases. So this is a few years ago now. And Ben Fordham, this like radio.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah, like radio right-wing shock jock. Had this sort of like come to Jesus moment because he was like getting all these property investors on the phone to talk about how bad the Greens were. And he had this property investor on and he was like, yeah, and I'm sure you are, you know, you're just doing it tough out there. You've got all these expenses. And if you don't mind me asking, he's asking, how many properties do you own? And the guy paused and he was like, And I think he realized that what he was about to say was a bit ridiculous. And he was like, 284. And Ben was like, sorry, what? And he said 284. And he's like, And it was this amazing
Ben's
moment where you saw these like two horses in Ben's head. And he was like, you can hear him go, I think there's everything's gonna be in moderation, right? Like And I thought it was a really clarifying moment because if you think about it, so this guy had 284 investment properties, which is such a wild
For journalistic integrity, I believe it was 238.
Oh, 238.
You know the figure. Like, wow.
Well, I put it in my little book,
I overinflated it.
My book, I'm a Millennial, available now.
And if you think about it, that guy could literally sell three, four investment properties every year and make millions of dollars and still have investment properties left over at the end of his life.
And get a capital gains tax discount.
On every single one. And I think the debate has started to shift. And you saw at the start of this, there was this sort of talk of the mum and dad investor. Mm. Now, and it was sort of incredible. And it's a sort of the way I think a lot of the conservative Australian media and political class will act is they can't win the argument that they think it's okay that like a family on a low income with kids should get evicted because they can't afford a $100 rent increase. They cannot win that argument.
Mm.
Like, and I've been on right-wing radio before when I've just started putting it to them, well, what do you think a reasonable rent increase? Do you think it's okay that they get evicted? And they'll go, well, I'm sure that investor has big expenses. So their strategy always is to divert the argument. Mm. And you'll notice this. And I think it's really important every time they do that just to have a bit of moral clarity about it. And you can go, well, at the end of the day, I have to sell. And if you think about it, I think the only time you ever lose those arguments is when you get caught up in that logic. Yes. And all of a sudden you're trying to defend this argument. You say, well, I know it's tough for you as well and I understand and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no.
Yeah, because that reeks of bullshit, which is what the Labor members on the panel did. This idea that we can solve the housing crisis without it working against some people, right? Yes. Like these interests are pitted against each other. And yes, I'm sorry, landlords are going to have to lose because at the moment they're winning too much. Yes. And to be able to say that and embrace the politics of us and them, as Andrew Lee put it, I mean, we have to do that. Otherwise we get
nowhere. Well, and pose the question, what are they losing, though? Yeah,
well, that's right. And losing it's all relative, right? Losing might be not making as much money off their investment property but still making a lot of money.
Which is a disgrace.
Yeah. And, you know, losing might mean, selling an investment property and making a $300,000 profit as opposed to a $500,000 profit. And as I said,
people were groaning in the room. I assume that's saying, wow, that's way less money. That would be tough.
Yeah.
Hang on a minute. That's $200,000 less.
Yeah, that's it. And the obvious point to make is losing for a renter is sleeping in their car. I think what's shifted, and I've noticed this in the public debate, is the rental crisis now is so bad and, you know, people seeing tents appear in the local park, but crucially also a lot of people either experiencing it themselves or now know someone who is experiencing it.
Mm.
And the moment that happens, the moment you see the pain in their eyes or you think about the implications of what they're going through in a wealthy country like this, like the devastating human consequences of not having any cap on rent increases, then you start to see the debate shift. And this is the other incredible thing about, you know, this, I'm not always a big believer in the Overton window. I think it's overstated as this thing, which is like the realm of accepted political debate. But I'm glad, and at the start of this, it was way off in the never-never, off to the right. But it was, if you think about it, housing, right? So one-third of this country rents. Think about it in these basic terms. It should not be radical to say that the price of this essential should have some regulation on it.
Mm.
Like this thing that you need to not sleep in the park with your kids should have some limit on the amount that you're charged for it. And really the radical position, and I think this is important, don't get caught being treated as the radicals. No, the radical position is to say that that family who otherwise couldn't afford any other house should be legally able to be subject to a $400 a week rent increase and have absolutely no recourse. Like, that's what the system that we have at the moment, I would argue, far more radical given the devastating consequences. But you do see, like, even that Q&A panel and all the time, is often we're left arguing about the very concept and the impacts it'll have on property investors, less the impact that it's actually having on renters.
Right now, with the status quo, yeah.
All
right, conscious of time, we want to get to our own little Q&A. If you have questions for Max, we want to get to them. But just, and so move through these last ones briefly. But I mean, the moment from this Q&A panel in which you landed in a bit of hot water, got a fair bit of attention, is when you got a question from Dan McKenna, who's the CEO of Nightingale, who was a not-for-profit property developer. And he asked, where do you and the Greens sit on the spectrum between NIMBYs and YIMBYs? And how do we convince those who are against medium-density development to get on board for the greater good? So this question about, you know, planning regulations, the way local councils affect on that, and the implication, of course, being that there are Greens councils out there who are stopping lots of developments. You said that planning is not the barrier to our housing crisis. Like immigration, it's a distraction used to avoid talking about the solutions we know have worked in the past. And there was basically a bit of a to and fro in which basically was summed up that you were trying to imply that planning has absolutely no impact on housing prices whatsoever. And you said it's almost as next to nothing compared to other factors. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that exchange. What did you want to say that you didn't get to? And I suppose the question I have is that, you know, if we like Nightingale, they do really good work. We want more Nightingales out there to do stuff. If they're asking this question about planning regulations, does that mean there's something to it, I suppose?
So I chatted to that guy from Nightingale afterwards, just as a little inside baseball, and I went up to him and was like, I'm pretty sure the Greens supported that development. He's like, yeah, they did. All the Greens councillors actually supported that development. And I was like, well, why didn't you say that? And he was like, I won't reveal the secrets of the ABC, but let's just say he implicated that he was encouraged to change the wording of the question.
Fucking hell.
So just to be very clear, and I sort of thought at this time, the Greens supported that and was blocked by other councillors. But anyway.
One of whom, I think James Conlon, who was formerly with the Greens, who left the party.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, as I said, ex-Greens.
This is who I believe Errol is referred to as a treacherous dog on the podcast.
Have I? That does sound like me, to be fair. I have no memory of that, but sure.
No, that sounds mean. The thing is they mix up these debates. On the one hand, medium density is good. Like, it's good and we want more medium density development. But again, planning reform is good to the extent that we want to sustainably densify our cities. But I want to be clear about this. That is separate to the cost and affordability of housing. Again, because you have to come back to the fact that right now there are a bunch of approved apartment towers around Australia, including in Brisbane, that developers are not building on. There is enough development land to supply housing for years. And to give you one example, AV Jennings, a single developer in Australia, has on I think they'll probably change their annual reports now, but they're being very transparent. And they've said, well, we have 11,000 approved lots of housing, approved for development ready. Guess how many they built on the year before?
Zero.
Well, close. I think just over 100. It's just not, it's factually incorrect to say that relaxing planning restrictions would have any impact on house prices. If anything, what happens when a developer sits on a block of land and then it's rezoned, say, from medium density to high density, the value of that land will go from about maybe 20 million to 60 million.
Mm.
And they get all of that value for free. And what they might do is that it actually often slows down the supply of housing, because if a developer knows they can sit on a block of land, wait 5 years for it to be rezoned rather than build on it, and then sell the land for a profit without ever having to build, that's what they'll do. And you'll walk through the city and you'll clock it. Like, there are vacant blocks of land in the city that are sometimes even vacant for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, the planning system is not a barrier to that. And occasionally a development might be knocked back, but it's so rare. So but in Sydney and Melbourne, for instance, over about a 10-year period, something like 95% of all planning applications were approved in those cities, 95%. And about 100,000 of those approved developments were never built on. So, like, I think it's an intuitive thing, right? They're like, oh, these councils are blocking housing and that's why the price of... And if only we got out of the way of the developers... The altruists that they are, they'll go out and just build all this house. And you laugh, right? Because it's completely ridiculous. It's like saying, look, the banks would give us cheaper mortgages if only we deregulated the banking system.
Yeah.
Like, there's this CEO of Commonwealth Bank is sitting there going, ah, if only the government got out of the way, I would half the price of our mortgages. Like, it's the same on planning. And this is the basic point. One of the things that they've developed, like the property industry has done actually pretty okay on, in progressive politics, in any other industry, if you had a bunch of right-wingers come along and say the solution to this is deregulation, we just need to deregulate this area, you would think, well, that's dumb, and I know how that ended up. And but in property, apparently it's an acceptable thing to talk about.
Okay, but aren't there a few, and Emerald and I have talked about a Yimby Nimby episode at some point, and it looks like we'll probably defer that again at some point. But, I mean, the examples that people cite are like heritage laws that seem a little bit insane, or laws that protect the character of the local neighbourhood. And it does seem that there are some groups that have the time and resources to dedicate to engaging with local council processes and campaigning against certain developments are often materially secure retirees or people have a lot of time, you know, that would fit the classic NIMBY category. I mean, is it true that there is some issue with some of those planning laws that do seem a bit silly and are prioritising aesthetic considerations over, you know, addressing the housing crisis?
Again, even if all of those planning regulations have changed to bulldoze all of those, frankly, like tiny fractions of a group compared to the house, to the housing crisis, it would not push down housing prices.
Yep.
Like, sure, you might get a few extra developments somewhere, but rents will keep going up and house prices will keep going up. Gentrification, right? Everyone knows the process of gentrification. That's the supply of private housing. Like, if you think about it, in an area where housing is affordable and then a private developer comes in and builds these luxury apartment towers and sells them for a premium price or private rent, that drags up the price of everything else in that area. So we've seen what happens when you let developers rip. If we had a public developer that wanted to build in a character area and instead of like, and we wanted to get rid of, say, like a warehouse and replace it with a beautiful medium density apartment tower, the rooftop garden and a childcare center better than the bottom, where it would be good for housing affordability would be if the rents were capped at 25% of income and the houses were sold at just over the cost of construction.
Yeah. Well, this is where I think I ended up being like, I don't know, I'm tired of the NIMBY YIMBY discourse, and it's probably not worth doing an episode on, is because people conflate that question of you know, maybe somewhere there's a bunch of rich property owners who might block public housing. Yes, that does happen and that's bad, but it's a completely different question to our opposition to just leaving housing to the private market.
Well, also there's very limited examples that I'm aware of where public housing has been blocked. Like, the bigger problem is government selling off public housing. So think about in Melbourne, right? They are just demolishing entire public housing towers. With the public housing tenants do not want to go. In Queensland, between about 2017 and I think about 2019, the Queensland Labor State government sold off 1,000 public homes onto the private market, not to the tenant. The way we discovered this was just door knocking, and we encountered this woman who said, "Oh, I'm really upset." And we're like, "Why?" And she's like, "Well, I was born in the front room of this public home, and I was told I had to move out by the Department of Housing because the Department of Housing basically evicted her into another house. The other house she was in, she hadn't unpacked her boxes because she was so emotionally distraught about losing her home. And then we found the home that they evicted out of, and the government had just rented it out onto the private market for about $200 to $300 a week more with the intention to sell it. And their hope was that they could sell every public home in a block to give it to a developer. This is the thing, right? Like, it's not like random members of the public blocking housing that's the problem. That is just not the problem. The problem is that governments, A, no longer want to build public housing like they used to, and they could. There's land across the city they could, and it would be very, I think, broadly supportive, especially if it meant teachers and nurses could get a good home and people on middle and higher incomes as well, in the way Europe does, say Vienna, which I talk about a lot. And two, they have an ideological opposition to it and keep selling it off. Like, and this is the trick they play, because if they keep getting to be like, oh, there's these random councils out there blocking public housing, the implication is if only, again, these random few councillors residents got out of the way, the government would solve the housing crisis. And we're expected to believe that these council, random little councils, are more powerful than the federal and state government combined. Like, it doesn't actually make any sense. And again, whenever they talk about planning or supply or, you know, these random councils or changing planning, The intention is not to solve the housing crisis. The intention is to distract from the fact that they do not want to solve the housing crisis.
Which I think was laid out with the final question of Q&A on the panel. Shout out to Annika in the audience who just asked, do you think house prices should go down? Which did not get a direct answer from the Labor MPs. Andrew Lee just said some bullshit, said he wants to end the blame game in housing. I'm sure you fucking do, mate. And Rose Jackson said, we absolutely have to moderate the growth in house prices.
So this is where polling's amazing on this, right? So there was a poll recently that said, do you think house prices should go up? And about, I think, 8 or 10% of Australians said they should go up.
Yeah.
And then it was about another 48% who said house prices should just stabilize, like 0% growth every year from here, and then 40% it should go down. So there's actually this, like, super majority, like 88% of people who in this country who either think house prices should go down or should have literally 0% growth.
Yeah.
But I tell you, and this is where I think this is a moment of moral clarity on the housing crisis. But who is in that 8%?
Mm.
It's banks, property developers, and property investors.
Labor MPs.
And
donors.
That's right. And like, if you think about it, was it like 65, 70% of Labor MPs have property investors? It's sort of a conflict of interest that they stand to financially gain if house prices keep going up. 65% of coalition MPs are property investors. It's sort of taboo to talk about, but it's true to say that what we have right now is a supermajority of property investors in Parliament unwilling to change any of the tax handouts that turbocharge house prices. And whether directly or indirectly, they get a financial benefit out of that. Mm-hmm. The ultimate winners, by the way, and we maybe don't have enough time to talk about this, out of the housing system, the banks, who do wield just a crazy amount of political power. Like, they just do. To give you a basic example, we're in Parliament a year ago now, and we got a deal on imposing $1 million fines on bankers. It was announced in the media.
Mm.
Like, Labor signed off on the deal. It was in the AFR, like, the paper of record for the capitalists. And they reneged on the deal because the head of the Australian Banking Association, so head of the bank lobby, do we know who that is?
Adam Blythe,
former Labor Premier, went into turbo drive. And in a lobbying madness, they got Labor to renege on a deal, which is a big deal, actually, that they don't often do because it does sort of break the way Parliament works.
Yeah.
And they just pulled the deal and said within 24 hours.
Mm.
And that's even on a small bit of regulation. Just to give you the idea of the power that the Australian banks wield, I would argue, actually, in many ways are more powerful than the mining industry. You just don't – and the way you know they're more powerful is there's less controversy about them in a way.
Yeah.
Like, you don't hear about them as much, but quietly in the background, they're sitting on a property portfolio. By the way, Australian property, it's worth over $10 trillion. Which is about five times Australia's GDP. And they sit on this enormous amount of wealth, wield an enormous amount of political power, and basically can get any rule change they want. And it just so happens that even if 88% of people think house prices should go down or not have 0% growth, that doesn't matter as long as that the banks think that house prices should keep going up.
Fuck! All right, we're going to leave questions for Max directly. We want to hear from you, but huge round of applause, please. Max Chandler-Mather, everybody, come on. Thank you, Max. Thank you for solving everything and explaining everything. We appreciate it. I also had questions about immigration and super, but we'll save those fun stuff for another time. Yeah. Anyone got any questions for Max Chandler-Mather about anything? Can be about housing, or if you're you're sick of that, we can talk about other stuff as well. Any questions at all? Yes, thank you.
So there's been
Max, I'll just repeat
the question.
Please go for it.
Yeah, whether there's modelling on changing or tax reform and what impact that would have.
Great question. So there's very limited modelling, and the one institution that has done some is the Grattan Institute, who I sort of disagree with. I think they're frankly, I think on housing in particular, they're quite a conservative outfit. They said that if you basically adopted Labor's policy on negative gearing and capital gains from 2019, house prices would go up by 2.5% less than they otherwise would. I actually think the impact would probably be greater. especially if you combined it with a mass build of public housing and the public developer and caps on rent increases. But again, you can sort of look at the historical example of what happened to house prices when you got introduced the capital gains tax discount and the 3% times more growth. Sorry, almost three times more growth than wages post the introduction of that. But it would definitely have some deflationary impact. It would certainly also, and they point, even Grattan Institute said this, you would see way less property investors in the market as well, which is great because if you're a first-time buyer going to an auction, you don't have that demoralizing experience of just being like, oh, I think I've saved up enough. And then a property investor's like, bang, $1 million. And you're like, oh, there we go. And that would happen a lot less as well.
And I think it's tying, because I think the problem with the Pocock-Lambie thing was there wasn't much discussion. It's like, okay, you've got all this new revenue. Where is that going? Where the Greens are saying, okay, wind back these tax concessions, use that money to invest in public housing. Like it's important to link those two, I think, when we're talking about winding back negative gearing. Like, we're going to use that new tax revenue to actually build more affordable housing for people.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
Any other questions? One over here.
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, sorry. Got to repeat this for the podcast. You won't hear all my funny jokes. That won't make any sense. Anyway, will the money foregone from winding back those tax concessions, negative gearing, capital gains tax, will that actually go to the budget? Because otherwise investors will go to franking credits, which I definitely understand. Max?
I'm not going to explain franking credits here, but it's a good question. There would be some behavioural change. So we asked the Parliamentary Budget Office about this. It's basically sort of like an independent arm that costs policies. And they said, yes, there would be some behavioural change, but it would still raise a lot of money because they can't dodge it all. Say if we introduce the Greens policy from 2022 on negative gearing, capital gains tax discount, so completely get rid of the 50% discount and phase out. And going forward, no one would be able to negatively gear, and people with one investment property currently would get to hold on to it. It would raise about, I think, $74 billion over the next 10 years, even with behavioural change, which is obviously a lot of money if you put that into public housing. So, yes.
Not in terms of submarines, though. It's not that much. Yeah. So,
that's true. It's about, like, what is that? Like a fifth of the submarines.
Yeah, yeah. It's the back part, I believe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's the reactor.
The reactor. Yeah, the important part.
Yeah.
I think there was someone up in the dark. Yes. question for the podcast is, why does Max get under Anthony Albanese's skin so much? Go ahead.
You might have to ask him that question. Look,
he's coming on next week.
Great. Right. it is odd, and I imagine part of it. I'm sure everyone here maybe has their own theories on this. It's a bit hard for me because it's sort of in the middle of it. But there's been some speculation. I mean, part of it I think is that he gets mad, I think, and a lot of Labor people get mad because they don't really have a policy argument against what the points that we're talking about. Mm. And what I say to people is when they get personal, and they can get quite personal, is because they've lost the policy argument. That's a bit of a nerdy thing to say, but it's true to the extent that, again, like if we're getting up and saying a single mum should not be evicted because she can't afford a rent increase, Labor can hardly get up and say, ha-ha, we think that should happen. instead, there has to be this attempt to degrade people's credibility. And
it's kind of like you put a mirror up in front of him, right, and force him to actually look at himself.
Yeah, I mean.
But I grew up in public housing.
Yeah. And I think this felt like what was been satisfying about this housing debate in a way is this is the first time I think we've forced a public discussion about a substantive structural shift in the economy in favour of ordinary and working people. And probably for the first time in a while, Labor was forced to defend a very conservative and in many ways neoliberal housing policy. And actually reveal, like, strip away all of the rhetoric. You know, they're really good at pretending like they're progressive without ever having any policy arguments for that, and stripping all of that away and laying bare just how right-wing, frankly, their housing policies are, I suppose is a confronting thing for them. Inside baseball, it was like, I think it was a mistake for the Prime Minister to attack a first-term Greens MP in the way he did. Like, you know, put it in those terms, like I'd been in Parliament for about a year and I was sitting in Parliament and, like, the Prime Minister was getting up, just laying into me. And all that did was provide a foundation for us to talk about freezes on rent increases. Like, and I think, as I understand it, there were some people from the Labor Party who weren't particularly happy that this was happening because it did just give us a platform to talk about solutions to the housing crisis. So
well, elevated you. It was Albanese versus Max, right? Like, as you say, first term Greens are better. I mean, you're the spokesperson.
Max's answer is, haters make me famous.
Or it's like,
turn your haters into waiters at the table of success.
Who said that? The New York mayor. But look, I don't. I have no. Frankly, have no idea. I did think it was slightly odd, and I don't think a particularly smart thing to do. But at the very least, it meant that more people know about freezes on rent increases and building public housing. So in that sense, it was a positive outcome.
You have to, like, you have a level of sympathy from his point of view. He's been like the left-wing guy, right, fighting Tories. He was on the left Labour Party forever. And you talk to Labour people and they really think this. Whatever the Labour Party is doing right now is as progressive as you can go. Like, that is what's in their head. Like, this is it. This is the left-wing answer where Labour is right now, right? And there, and anyone to their left is seen as a secret Tory or betraying the movement or whatever or being naive or whatever. They still cannot process the idea that there is this huge mass of the population and a political movement to their left that they simply don't know how to deal with.
Well, yeah, and like I've talked about this before, but Labour's biggest asset is low expectations and creating this perception that like there's not much we can do actually, and actually on the housing crisis the best we can do is give 10,000 lucky winners out of 5 million people the chance to buy a home. Like imagine like Albo like spinning a wheel being like I was like, and like there's all these renters sitting in a crowd and like, sorry, 99.8% of people, you all lose but you win. That's right, Tom. Like, that is genuinely what they do. And it is, and it's been useful and important to point out, like, what we're asking for is what a lot of countries around the world already do and Australia used to do. And what we need to get from is this complete lie that Labor aren't going further because they, for some, you know, technical reason, can't. Get away from that and get to the point that, no, they're not going further because they don't want to challenge the financial interests of the banks and the property industry, and they're not willing to stand up for them on behalf of the millions of renters getting screwed. Like, they have made a choice, and that choice is, do we stand up to those huge financial interests and fight for ordinary people, or do we kowtow to those interests and throw the millions of people getting screwed by the housing crisis to the wolves? And they've made their choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a confronting thing to be made public for them, but nonetheless an important one to point out.
Max Chalamet for everybody!
Is that all we have time for? My watch doesn't work, so I've been trying to like look at.
Oh no, yeah, we need to wrap up. I'm sorry. Yes, yep. We need to wrap it up. We are back at 2 o'clock. 2 o'clock for the late show. But we get naughty. We're going to come back. We have a bit of a break. We are selling merch in that break.
We are. We have some shirts. There are very few sizes left. But if you like the color jade or teal, as some people have said, you're in luck. Also, if you're a very small person, you are also in luck.
That's going to be up there just at the barrel outside the door. We've got my phone to take card payments and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And if you just want to come up and say, hey, grab a photo or whatever, you're very welcome to do so.
Yes.
We want to say a huge thank you, of course, to Max, of course, we've done that. we want to say please, we want to thank the wonderful people here at Good Chat for hosting us. Give it up for Good Chat, everyone. Good Chat, the best comedy club in Melbourne, yes. And if you're coming back to the late show, that's fantastic. If you're not, thank you for listening to our podcast. We love you very much. And please recommend Serious Danger to your comrades to build the revolution. Yeah?
That's right. That's it. Thank you very much. See you soon.
Thanks, everyone.